On today's show, the Red Deer Hospital finally hits the jackpot. Ukraine enters a real state of emergency. The Canadian government tries to define hatred. And the CBC finds itself stuck in a ditch. This is Penhold Talk Radio. And welcome back to the show. Thank you for choosing to spend some of your time with us. My name is Brian Constantine. I am here with my co-host, Michael Rowland.
Hello, hello.
And we got a whole bunch of stuff to get to today. And let us start off with just a couple public service announcements. The first one has to do with the town of Penhold. If your garbage didn't get picked up this last weekend, we might have a clue as to why.
Sounds like they're getting a little strict on that 1 meter buffer they require around your bins.
Yeah, this is a different kind of social distancing, I think, isn't it?
Now your garbage has to social distance too.
Yeah, you have to social distance your garbage from your recyclables and any other object around it.
Yeah, they've been pretty lenient for a while now, I guess. But the company that collects the garbage and recycling have had enough, and they're not going to do it anymore. Yeah,
I've seen them do pretty tight pickups.
Yeah.
But yeah, they, so over this last week, and apparently the town got a number of calls about garbage not being picked up. And I think the waste disposal company actually left stickers behind saying, this is why your garbage didn't get picked up.
Yeah. I didn't get to see it, but I'm guessing the passenger guy with the garbage is going around slapping stickers on them,
I guess. But yeah, so the town sent out, Facebook post this evening and mentioned that or as a reminder, keep your garbage bins and your recycle bins 1 meter apart, or 3 feet if you're still in the Imperial, and also a meter from your car. But I think people will do that automatically. You know, they're a little more protective with the car than their bins.
Yeah.
So there's one public service announcement. The other one is if you're looking for your Frito-Lay chips, you might have to stick to the local IGA. So, apparently there's a bit of a squabble going on between Frito-Lay's, which makes your Lay's chips and your Doritos and your Cheetos, and Loblaws. And Loblaws has a whole bunch of different brands. Here it would be like No Frills and the Real Canadian Superstore. So if you've gone shopping over this last week, you might have known the chip aisle has a significantly fewer selections for you and your snacking options this weekend. Frito-Lay's wants to up the price because they think they're saying it costs more for them. Loblaws is saying, no, we got to keep it down for the customers and your price increase is not justified. So they're playing a game of corporate chicken right now. So see who blinks first in this battle. In the meantime, stick with the local IGA. I checked them out tonight, this being Thursday night. They still have full stock of all your Frito-Lay's goodies.
Just know inflation might be hitting your Frito-Lay's.
It's hitting everything. It's hitting everything. I really noticed it this last trip.
Yep.
Like, it's not like it was $6 for no name butter now. No name.
$6
for one block of no name salted butter.
Oh man.
I was conscious of this when I was buttering my bread in the morning this past week. That it was actually I almost could count the cents at each swipe.
Yeah.
Like this is costing me 10 cents to butter my bread now, kind of idea.
So the next thing we need to petition with the town is when they finish with these backyard chickens, let's get backyard cows.
Oh no.
I need to save money.
Don't do that. Oh, we're having a hard enough time with the chickens. You're the cows are just, I couldn't imagine that one. You might have to fight them for that one for sure. There's people against chickens in principle. You're bringing in cows. Yeah. Oh, good luck on you and to you for that one. All right. So there's your public service announcements. Keep your garbage bins, social distance your garbage bins, and shop local if you want your Frito-Lay's. You've been notified now. On to other news. So the provincial budget has been announced, and we are not going to bore you with that. So don't worry, don't fret. If you want all that kind of info, We'll put up a link on our website, penholdtalkradio.ca. If you go to each episode, has its own page that you go to that will have all the links, audio versions, to the video versions of the show, and then also has all the sources and articles that we're kind of referencing or drawing from. So penholdtalkradio.ca, right at the front page there, if you scroll down a little bit, there's usually the latest episode that you can click on, and it'll pull you over to the most recent episode site, and you can find all the good stuff there.
If you happen to be one of those 10 people in the province that wants to read this budget, it'll be there.
Yeah, it's there. But more specifically, I just wanted to, I'm sure you guys have probably come across this already, but I think it's worth noting that Red Deer, that the province has recognized that Red Deer has a hospital.
Ooh.
It's recognized that a lot of people use it, and it needs a lot of money. And fortunately, all of those things have kind of coalesced in this last week. And the Alberta government has really opened up the old purse strings on this one.
Yeah.
To the tune of $1.8 billion, basically over the next 8 to 9 years, to expand the Red Deer Regional Hospital. It's worth noting that the hospital here serves close to 500,000 people in the central Alberta region. And over half the people, or around half the people that actually use the hospital, are from outside of Red Deer. And so it's servicing a huge area. We're not just talking about the 100,000 people inside of Red Deer itself.
Yeah.
It's a large kind of a collection center, or a collection area for the hospital. So $1.8 billion over the next 8 to 9 years. They're aiming to raise the bed capacity from 370 to 570.
That is a significant
improvement. So that's a big jump. A little bit of history on this. When Red Deer Hospital first started in 1904, I was doing a little history on this one, there was capacity for 23 people. and it's also worth noting that when the first hospital was built in Red Deer, they actually ran out of money before they finished the building of it.
Yeah.
And so the town had to chip in $12,000 at the time to finish it. So, you know, everything comes back around, you know, we're again needing money to have upgrade the hospital now. At least there's one built.
Yeah.
So yeah, 372 to 570, three new operating rooms. So we're going from 11 to 14 there. The other big news, I think, was the cardiac catheterization lab that's going to be brought in to the Red Deer Hospital. I think this has been a big ask for a lot of people who've been kind of focusing on this issue. This is a key procedure in order to diagnose a lot of issues, particularly around heart issue or heart diseases and complications, but also just to treatment as well when it comes to removing clogged arteries, especially soon after a heart attack.
Yeah.
Before, people would have to go down to Edmonton or Calgary. And this is one of the arguments that people were making, is that that was actually reducing the lifespan of central Albertans, was partly because of this.
Right. Yeah. So now not only can you do the diagnostic and preventative, we can deal with these emergencies right locally.
Yep. And again, a little bit of background on this. This is the cataract catheterization. It's funny how casually some of these words are thrown out and treatments are thrown out. And so I had to quickly look it up. I think I had an idea of what it was, but I went onto I think the Mayo website or something like that, the Mayo Clinic. And so this procedure involves opening up access to an artery, usually in the leg or groin region or in the neck, and threading a small tube down your artery into your heart in order to, say, take a biopsy or to scan things out or do an angioplasty, you know, where they kind of put stents in around your heart or clean out your arteries. And the little paragraph that was talking about this ends or mentions that that you don't have to actually be you're not anesthetized, so you're awake during this, but you'll be given medications to relax. And then it says recovery time for cardiac catheterization is quick, and there's a low risk of complications. So yeah, so
just
it's
so casual.
It's so easy. Yeah, we're just gonna we're just going to open up an artery, you know, one of those main blood pathways through your body. We're just going to put a little straw down there, a little tube, and we're just going to check things out. No big deal. We are living in a blessed time.
Yeah, no kidding. 100 years ago, and that'd be completely unheard of. You just die.
It's magical. It's unfathomable. Try to explain this process to someone, even 50 years ago. I'm not even sure how long we've been doing this, but, 150 to 100 years ago, so many different medical procedures now are done with such casualness that we just forget the incredible sophistication and knowledge that we have now. So that's the one new procedure that's coming in. Again, a little historical note here. I think it's funny to think about. So that first hospital around the turn of the 1900s, the board set admission rates for patients at $7 for public wards and $10 for private rooms. And then there's also a fee schedule for the hospital's operating room. Now here's the kicker. Patients were expected to provide their own medicine and surgical dressings. So yeah, you just go out and source your parts as you were, the parts that you need to fix yourself up, bring it in and we'll install them for you.
That's like going to a restaurant and you bring your own food and the chef will cook it.
Yeah.
Such a weird concept now.
Yeah. I'm glad that's all in-house now. But yeah, so like I said, we've moved on a long ways from in the medical field from even 50 to 100 years ago. So at least on that front, we are remarkably blessed people for living in this time. And so with this new expansion coming in, I think this and these new services, I think this is, again, helps to elevate Penhold particularly to be another or to be a place where living here throughout your life is a viable option. I know Mary Argeau, this is a topic or kind of a goal of his, and number of other people, is to make Penhold as long term viable in the long term as possible. This isn't just kind of your bedroom family community, but you can actually grow up and live here your entire life.
Yeah, for as much as we have such a young population here, a lot of the counselors talked about the idea that you may want to raise your family here and continue to live here into your older years. And having such good, well-developed medical care so close by will make that much more reasonable.
Yeah. All those young families here, there's grandparents that are connected there. And so this is just one other perk that might mean that grandma and grandpa can stay a little bit closer, instead of having to go down to Edmonton or Calgary.
Yeah.
All right. So that's kind of some big news in on the kind of the more local front. Moving out to the national and really international levels now. Last week we talked about the Trudeau government and their invoking of the Emergencies Act.
Yeah.
It reminds me, This Hour Has 22 Minutes. They put out a great little skit about...
Oh, I haven't watched it.
Yeah, I'll have to show it. And again, another link I'll post up on the website. But the show is a guy in a number of different life situations. His wife or his girlfriend is about to leave him. And he's like, I invoke the Emergencies Act. As if this like solves the problem of everything in life now.
It's like so, the Michael Scott declare bankruptcy.
Yeah, I declare bankruptcy. Yeah. But yeah, so it was just last week that Trudeau declared the Emergencies Act, and fought tooth and nail to get through the House of Commons. The NDP reluctantly, apparently, went along with it, and then it got through the House of Commons. And was starting to be debated in the Senate, which was a little less certain of its passability there. And so it was only 36 hours after it passed the House of Commons that Trudeau said, emergency over, we're good now, and declare and revoked the Emergencies Act. Now, the it just seems so sudden, and a lot of commentators are making this point as well. You look at the Senate, it wasn't sure it was going to pass through the Senate. You had no blockades or protests going on anywhere, especially that would justify a national state of emergency. Bank accounts were actually being unfrozen. So there's all these things were piling up. And yet this was just 36 hours prior to being taken out. This was set up as a pseudo confidence vote, a vote which means that if this was voted down, if the House of Commons voted against the Emergencies Act, it could have triggered an election. Like that's how the Liberals presented it.
Right.
And yet 36 hours later, it's gone.
So what was the point of this whole process?
That's the difficult thing to kind of grasp. Part of the justification that Trudeau mentioned was that this Emergencies Act was kind of necessary to restore the faith and stability and trust in you know the institutions of the state. And yet when it seems to be just on and off like this in such questionable manner, I think it ends up doing the exact opposite. And my cynical side says that this just ends up being a demonstration of our prime minister's pride and need to show his power. Like, I don't even think it's ideological. Like, I don't think there's any grand or any kind of grand worldview behind this. I think he was annoyed by the truckers going against what he thought was best. And once he labeled these unacceptable views, he couldn't go out and talk with them, which likely could have ended this thing really easily.
Locked himself into a position where the last thing he had left to do was to pull out the biggest, strongest weapon he had and wave it around.
Or show some humility and perhaps go and at least send someone out to go talk with him. Yeah. But these were pariahs that he just couldn't. He's labeled them with unacceptable views and Nazis and you know, waving around swastikas and all this name calling. He puts himself in a position where he has to show humility or power. And he went with the power.
The pride got the best of him and go with the wave around the biggest weapon and show your strength.
That seems to be, I think a lot of people are struggling for why this was put in place. And I think it seems to be as good an answer as I've thought up of. And I do that because I think all of us can recognize that when we're put back in the corner, we are, I think all of us aren't quick to, lay down the shield or the sword when we're kind of felt like we're trapped or cornered, we want to fight back against things.
Yeah.
And so I think this is just a reflection of human nature. I don't think there's anything special about Trudeau and his position. I think he reflected himself being a human, and perhaps the worst part of our nature. And it just, when you have that much power, that pride and enacting on that pride has larger ramifications than perhaps you and I would have when we might refuse to humble ourselves when necessary.
But yeah, does that show of strength or whatever you want to call it, does that really induce feelings of trust and confidence in a leader? That's my question. I don't feel that way. I don't feel like that produces any level of trust in a leader, that they back themselves into a corner and then try to come out swinging.
Yes, it does seem like they end up being, ends up kind of coming across as almost petty.
Yeah.
I know the word tyrannical has been thrown around a lot, especially even the New York Times was yeah, was very critical and of what was going on up in Canada and the decision that Trudeau made. I think in the end, it does a lot of the opposite. It actually produces mistrust in the government that they can actually wield the power that they have responsibly. And so when other bills come along, we'll talk about later in the show, when other bills come along that have like significant societal impact, particularly, I'm not so comfortable with them putting these forward because I don't trust them to use them appropriately.
Yeah.
And so this I think will have a long, this is not that people have a lot of trust in politicians in the first place, but this does not help that reputation at all.
Yeah.
So Trudeau had the Emergencies Act. I mentioned all the things that kind of led up to perhaps him pulling the plug on it now. You know, the Senate perhaps voting it down. There's no protest going on. Bank accounts being unfrozen. I think the other thing that might have prompted this was that Ukraine declared a state of emergencies, exactly like we did. So we instituted a state of emergencies. Our Emergencies Act actually has a 30-day limit as well. Ukraine puts in their state of emergency. It also has a 30-day act. Basically, it's martial law.
So it's ultimately the same equivalence.
Yeah, it's equivalent.
State.
Yes.
But not an equivalent scenario.
Yes. So if the U.S. was attacking Canada, this is the kind of legislation that would be put in place. Is the Emergencies Act, the formerly known as
the War Measures Act.
Yes. And so now you got Trudeau on Monday announcing sanctions. I think it was on Monday. Because on Tuesday he revoked it. So I think it was on Monday was when Putin announced that the eastern provinces of Ukraine were going to be independent from Ukraine. He just decides that. And so a whole bunch of these sanctions come out. Trudeau and a lot of different countries announce sanctions, but I'm not sure when Ukraine started to institute their state of emergency law, but it was shortly thereafter, right in the same window. And so you end up having this optic where Trudeau has the state of emergency going on in Canada and Ukraine has a state of emergencies. One of these is not like the other.
Yeah.
And no perhaps kidding. that might be just one more factor in why this was pulled to begin with. So in Ukraine that actually has a state of emergencies, the news is filled now with scenes of Russia actually making inroads and bombing certain places all over Ukraine.
Missiles everywhere. I saw a map and it's circling the entire Ukraine where the bombings have been happening.
Yep.
So
they're attacking from the east. They're coming down from the north through Belarus. Yep. So this is a true state of emergency. There have been some just stunning, shocking video coming out. Oof. One in particular, I don't know if you saw it. It was of a Russian jet flying over the treetops, and it just looks like a speck. And then in a heartbeat, it's like over. It just flies over top, and you see streaks of smoke coming down, and hitting to the camera's left, and the camera starts shaking around because those were missiles that had just been launched from this thing, just buzzing across it. I think it's hard for us in North America to just understand war, and just what it means to be in actually a state of war, a state of true emergency.
Yeah.
But when Europe just has that kind of ingrained history now, you see the history of war all over that ancient continent.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, every time it happens, this is just shocking visuals end up coming out of it. In fact, this is the first time since the Second World War that a European state has faced the prospect. I'm reading from a National Post article. First time a European state has faced the prospect of total military conquest by a foreign sovereign power. So this isn't everyday kind of stuff here.
Yeah.
This isn't, Afghanistan tribal warfare kind of going on. This is the heavyweights. This is Russia.
Yeah. It's one country invading another. This is a pretty serious matter.
So here in Alberta the Ukrainian flag was placed beside the speaker's chair in the Alberta legislation. Apparently Canada has the third most people of Ukrainian heritage after Ukraine and after Russia. We have the most all the countries have the third most people here from with Ukrainian heritage. Some 1.3 million people in Canada can trace their lineage back to some sort of Ukrainian ancestry. So this is I think on the minds of a lot of Canadians.
Yep.
When it comes to that, it comes to what's going on over in Ukraine. As far as the Canadian actual military involvement, this is we've sent over 3,400 troops, not into Ukraine, but into neighboring NATO countries. So NATO is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and it's basically a cooperation of countries that have promised to fight for one another should they be attacked.
Yeah, basically the deal is if you invade a NATO country, you invade NATO.
Yes.
And it's all kind of the all for one and one for all.
Yeah, it's kind of the Musketeers kind of thing going on here.
Yeah.
And that was one issue that has prompted this from Russia, is that Ukraine wanted in on that action, that protection.
That would have put NATO pretty close to them.
That puts NATO and the U.S. is involved in that. They're concerned about U.S. putting stuff that close to the Russian border. They've always had issues with the military placements along their Russian border. Even if it wasn't directly on the border, just the proximity to it has always riled up Russia.
So if for no other reason, Ukraine becomes a buffer for them from NATO.
And so Ukraine was trying to get in. The idea here is this, that if Russia takes over Ukraine, they can set up their little puppet regime and no longer will Ukraine want to be part of NATO. Like you said, creates a bit of a buffer around there. I think that's one reason. I think there's a lot of different reasons for why this is happening. But that's at least one. Canada is also sending in the HMCS Halifax to the Black Sea, which is it's on the southwest of border of Ukraine. In fact, I think Crimea. So here's a little interesting fact. So Crimea was annexed by Russia in 2014. So the Crimea is like a province, a peninsula that sticks out from the southern part of Ukraine into the Black Sea, and it has a lot of Ukrainian or a lot of Russian heritage and people there with Russian ties. At least is the kind of the justification that Russia uses. And so they annexed that in 2014, a few days after the Sochi Olympics of 2014. Mm. A few days after the Beijing Olympics, now they're deciding to take a little more. Coincidence? Who knows?
Olympics cause international problems.
So we have at least 3,400 troops over there. We have a military frigate over there. I'm not sure what class of the Halifax is. So we got some personnel over there now. So this isn't something that, Canada's keeping an eye on, and part of that, like I said, part of the NATO agreement seems like this is our obligation. We got to send someone over there to protect the NATO boundaries, as it were. Though I'm doubtful that Russia. Putin is a cagey guy. I don't think he's interested in taking over Europe, at least at this time. I think he's a little bit wiser than that.
If he can pull off taking over Ukraine,
he can
stop there and have his buffer and not interfere with NATO.
When you're president for life, you can take things leisurely. You don't have to worry about the next election or something like that. So he's got time to kind of fulfill what he wants. Canada has also decided to fast track Ukrainian applications for people who want to get out of Ukraine and move over to Canada. Though it's been pointed out that Canada is still dealing with an influx of Afghan applications
after the turmoil there not that long
ago.
No,
what was that? It was in August. I think it was August.
Yeah,
that feels like a long time. Well, yeah, I think it's around the August time.
So we're looking at only 6 months ago.
Yeah,
that happened. We're dealing with that, and now we're trying to bring in Ukrainians as fast as we can.
Yeah, good. I think this is a good step. It's just one of those things. There's just so many layers of bureaucracy and paperwork and red tape. you can say all these things, but you can't actualize them. You can't actually manifest them into existence by just speaking them. In fact, there's one article about a poor guy named Jawad Hakmal. He was a translator with the Canadian military in Afghanistan. He was fortunate enough to get out of Afghanistan, but only with the help of apparently the Canadian newspaper, the Globe and Mail, pulling some strings to help that process along. So he's able to get pulled out of Afghanistan, and they move him over to Kiev, the capital of Ukraine.
Poor guy.
And now he's in the middle of this. Oof. And so people like that are like, I know what you're saying, but my experience is completely different. Like, we need to speed this process up if it's going to be anything effectual to actually move people out of harm's way in a timely manner.
Yeah.
So Canada's also announced all these sanctions, like I said, along with a lot of other countries. The problem, though, with these sanctions, is that they're trying to balance sanctioning Russia without hurting hurting their own economies. This is particularly true for say Europe, and Germany in particular, where they get so much of their natural gas and oil from Russia.
Yeah,
like that's their main thrust here. And if I may just poke one other bear as well with this, is that part of the need for more Russian oil is because a lot of these Western countries are going to more green sources of power, and those green sources of power aren't ready to make up for shutting down all those harmful fossil fuel factories. And because of that, you're going to have to bring this oil from somewhere because you still need that energy.
So they're making themselves more dependent on a country that won't put in those green plans.
Yep.
And will happily provide all the fossil fuels you want.
And this is the quagmire you put yourself in, is that now how are you going to sanction these countries and not hurt yourself in the process?
Yeah.
So for example, so Bloomberg has an article mentioning that, so the sanctions were put in on Monday. The following 24 hours after these sanctions were put in place, over $700 million were bought of Russian oil, gas, and commodities were bought by the West. $700 million
worth, in 24 hours
after sanctions were put in place. And then in Canada, over the last decade, we've imported $3.6 billion in Russian oil over the last 10 years, including over $300 million in this last in 2021. Now we are still a net exporter, so we're still putting out more oil, which seems like there's something wrong going on there.
Yeah,
I won't mention the problem Quebec, but I won't.
So we're
this is an issue. Again, it's not like we can sanction these countries and just say we're good. You know, this if you really want to put the screws to these guys and hurt them, though Russia and themselves have a massive stockpile apparently of some $600 billion in assets that they plan long term for this kind of stuff. But if you're going to try to put on the sanctions that hurt the most, you're going to have to hurt yourself if you've put yourself in this kind of situation where you're depending upon these terrible world actors for your money.
Yeah.
Or for your oil or for your energy dependence. And so this is the problem that many countries find themselves in, is that Ukraine is not part of NATO, so they don't really want to put in military forces on the ground. Canada has shipped finally some lethal weapons to Ukraine, reluctantly, I think. We've spent the last 8 years kind of training up some of their military, so it's not like we've done nothing to help them out. But right now, Ukraine's on their own as far as when it comes to military assistance.
Yeah, nobody's stepping in to Ukraine.
No, yeah, you're not going to find any other
hovering around the borders waiting for something to happen involving NATO directly.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no one eager to jump in there. And Putin knows this.
Yeah.
In fact, the Ukrainian president tweeted out that he's giving away 10,000 small arms to the people in Kiev. Like just calling the citizenry of Kiev. He's giving away 10,000 weapons just so they can protect themselves.
Oh yeah. You'd see videos of people training with just like wooden models of guns just to train how to use the gun so that the moment they can get their hands on it, everybody's prepared to fight.
Yeah.
Because they've got no support from the rest of the world. They're standing there on their own trying to face the giant that is Russia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it's hard to be optimistic when you have a West that's put themselves in the bind that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And Russia being knowing full well the position they're in and taking advantage of it, all run by the psychopath that is Vladimir Putin. It's hard to be optimistic about the kind of the outcome, what's going to happen over the next number of days and weeks ahead. I will put out on our website a link to an article that has a series of different charities and organizations that you can check out and if you so decide, donate to. I think Red Cross is always on there, but there are a couple other ones that you can take a look at. So it's hard to you feel helpless out here.
Yeah.
And so if nothing else, there is some organizations out there that you can take a look at and that if you feel so moved that you can actually donate to and hopefully help out the situation, at least in some small way, if nothing else, help them recover when this is over. So back at home here, where fortunately Trudeau has determined that the emergencies are over, there are other bills that are worth discussing and discussing within the context of kind of the fallout from the Emergencies Act. When you use such powerful legislation in these frivolous ways, I think it does the exact opposite of what Trudeau was hoping. Instead of looking at what he did and saying, yes, I trust your judgment on these big topics. It actually does the opposite. You know, you show yourself that you can't responsibly wield this kind of power. And so when other bills come along that seem to have significant ramifications, it's something that we need to be extra aware of when they do come up.
Are we confident giving that power to our leaders?
Exactly. And so then kind of the next bill, or at least the bill that is, and also is perhaps being pushed forward a little bit faster based upon the trucker convoy, is this bill, or what's being dubbed the anti-hate bill. And the idea here is that it's connected to the trucker convoy and our diversity. So we have a diversity minister, which again, just makes me shake my head.
Yeah.
Hamad Hussein said this, said seeing symbols of hate right across the doorstep of our parliament is unbelievable and should be condemned. And so he's referring to the trucker convoy and how I think the only images I've seen were on like the first weekend, right, when they had perhaps their largest turnout, is that you had one or two guys that had a swastika painted on a flag or a full on swastika flag. I think I only saw one of those. And apparently there's a Confederate flag somewhere.
Yeah.
But I saw far more bouncy houses and semi-trucks.
And makeshift hot tubs. And
yeah. They had a DJ set up there. Like,
it was more like a really oversized block party than most of what it was made out to be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it just got overextended for, it went from block party to emergency somewhere in there, as all block parties tend to do.
Of course.
But that, seeing those images, apparently has kind of reinvigorated this need to adjust the Criminal Code of Canada and the Human Rights Act to adjust it to incorporate strength, they're more strength against and define hate speech. Particularly, I think particularly this is aimed towards like online speech in particular. And so this was originally presented as Bill C-36 before the last election. They're working on it again. But the idea here is to criminalize some forms of hate speech. And the tricky part has always been is how do you define that? How do you define hate or hatred? And fortunately, they try to do that in this act. So here's how they define hate, or I guess define hatred. It says hatred means the emotion that involves detestation or vilification and that is stronger than dislike or disdain. And then it continues on. For greater certainty, the communication of a statement does not incite or promote hatred for the purposes of this section solely because it discredits, humiliates, hurts, or offends. All right. So it can't be considered hatred if it just simply discredits someone, humiliates someone, even hurts or offends someone. It has to be categorized as detestation or vilification. Now, to me, this seems like my kid's synonym spelling lesson. Like, I'm going to give you a word. Now give me a synonym that means the exact same. But I just give me, if I just tell you a synonym for a word, I actually haven't told you the definition of it.
Yeah.
So it kind of feels like that. So again, hatred on this act would say is defined as hatred means the emotion that involves detestation or vilification and that is stronger than dislike or disdain. So you have to, so this is the problem. How can you prove that? Especially in a court of law. First of all, it's an emotion. How do you know the difference between dislike and hatred? Like, and how come I couldn't just show up in court and say, no, I really just did not like that person a lot. Like, this seems like you're judging the soul of a person if on this definition.
Yeah.
And that just seems like a very ambiguous definition to set up, because then who gets to decide when my emotions transform from dislike and disdain to detestation or vilification? Like, what's the threshold here are you putting that defining line in here? That's really like, I don't know what I'm, it's hard for me even as an individual to say, perhaps when I move from dislike to hatred, like, can you clearly say when your emotions change from dislike to hatred?
It's not a measurable, there's no metric you can look at to say that that's the line I have crossed to go from dislike to hatred. So how can somebody, like, you can't do that with your own feelings. How can somebody else gauge that?
Yeah. And the fact that it's all tied to emotion, it doesn't have to, it's not based upon outward action. Like, yeah. It's, like, I'm guessing that's how you'd have to define the emotion, because you can't look at someone and say that emotion was hatred and not dislike. Like, yeah, it doesn't make any sense. And so it's just really weird that this would be put in as the definition. And in fact, this is kind of, they're taking some of this language from actual Supreme Court case already that kind of uses the same language. And I would have the same critique there.
Yeah.
Like, sure. Okay. Again, you're just saying hatred is detestation, but that's not really a definition. That's just a synonym.
Yeah.
And it doesn't provide me with kind of any external objective way of verifying it. So if I say something, how do you know it's being said as something reflecting something I dislike or something that I hate? I'm reflecting hatred towards, like, you can say a lot of things and use the exact same words, and in theory, you say them in very different ways with different emotions behind
them. Yeah.
But you, by just looking at the words or even how someone says it, there's just no way to. I don't see an objective way of declaring this act or this speech is hate based upon this definition. Especially if this is being set up to apply to online language as well.
So like, if you're going to apply this to online, you're losing a lot of communication there and taking it right down to written text, I guess with emojis and so on now.
Yeah.
But
yeah, hate emoji or something. Yeah. I like, oh.
So yeah, so if you use a really angry looking emoji, do they say, well, okay, that's crossed into hatred now?
Yes.
Like, what are we doing?
Yeah, like it's hard enough to tell when someone's being sarcastic or not in text.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much miscommunication. Like, our daily experience in just texting, even the people we know the best, the miscommunication that happens between the people we know the best just through our text messages should show us how ridiculous this is, especially when applied to online situations.
Yeah.
Yeah. So at least they try to put it in there, but it's so untestable, so unverifiable. So there's no way that someone here could, you can have two people look at this and then look at this definition and you can give them the same case and they could reasonably argue against one another.
Like, you could argue against yourself one day to the next, depending on your mood.
Yes.
Like, you're going to read into it differently depending how you feel. So it becomes an extremely subjective metric to try to gauge whether it's hate speech or not.
Yeah. So like I said, this is the law that's kind of being crafted by a government that's shown itself to be iffy in some of these big decisions. And this is kind of a key legislation that they're going to be promoting. Because it's apparently needed in to protect the people against hate speech. So they're going to make a big deal about this. And yet you got these kind of very nebulous language and definitions. Are you comfortable, knowing what you know about the government now, to apply that kind of ambiguous power appropriately? I don't know.
No.
But anyways, another element of this law, it says that let's read this from here. It says, a person may, with the attorney general's consent, lay an information before the provincial court judge if the person fears on reasonable grounds that another person will commit an offense under section 318 and section 319, an offense under subsection 430. These are all kind of definitions on kind of hate language. And then continues, an offense motivated by bias, prejudice, or hate based on race, national or ethnic origin, language, color, religion, sex, age, mental or physical disability, sexual orientation, gender identity or expression, or any other similar factor. So let me read that again. So a person may, with the attorney general's consent, lay an information before the provincial court judge. So you can bring something with the attorney general to a court or to a judge, relating to if the person fears on reasonable grounds that another person will commit.
So we're talking
has committed.
We're talking pre-crime.
Will commit an offense motivated by bias, prejudice, or hate based upon race and so on and so forth.
Pre-crime. We're really talking about that.
Well, it's a crime that you will commit. So it's a crime right now for an action that you we're going to perhaps do in the future.
What was that Tom Cruise movie?
But if I stop that person before they commit I don't know. I'm getting confused now.
Yeah. What was that Tom Cruise movie?
It's Minority Report.
Minority Report. Yeah. Minority Report for hate crimes that you can't judge objectively. This is really weird.
I don't know of any other, like, I guess I'm thinking, you know, I don't know, even police sting operations, you know, or a conspiracy to commit a crime or something like that. Like, you're actually being kind of convicted or punished for the act of conspiracy itself. You're not actually being
for the crime.
It's just planning to crime or to commit a crime. I guess that's what they're going.
So
here.
This is conspiracy to commit conspiracy, hate.
Yeah, to commit hate speech.
Hate speech, not a hate crime, but hate speech.
Yeah. An offense motivated. So it's quite broad. You can, even before you actually type up that hateful Facebook post or newsletter or whatever, or video, if someone is aware of that and has reasonable grounds, you're planning to do that, they can go to a judge with the attorney general and ask for the court to get involved. And you know, what is that involvement? All right, so it continues on. It says the provincial court may add any reasonable conditions to the recognizance that judge considers desirable to secure the good conduct of the defendant. So you bring your case to the judge. The judge says, yes, there is reasonable grounds that this person was going to commit this hate speech or hate crime. And the judge then can basically, the recognizance is an obligation or a condition put on you by the court.
Right.
So think like, and so it provides examples. So if you are found guilty of planning to commit a hate speech, these are some things that could happen. You could be required to wear an electronic monitoring device, so an ankle bracelet. You could require the defendant to return to and remain at their place of residence at specified times. They could,
so like a form of house arrest, basically.
Yeah, this is basically on probation.
Yeah.
It lists a number of different things regarding that. But basically, yeah, you can think of it as probation. It can limit, they can require the defendant to restrain or abstain from drugs and alcohol. And all this, fortunately, this is limited to only 12 months. so no more than 12 months. If you're really bad, then up to two years, I think. This is all, like I said, this is all for just someone having presented a case where you're planning to commit some sort of hate crime or hate speech, on this definition. So, and just, like I said, I'm just reading from the law here. I'm feeling uncomfortable with the government having this kind of power.
Yes.
Or at least putting this power out there, because another thing with this law is that it's not actually the politicians kind of deciding this. Some of this is decided by the court. Some of this authority is going to be presented down to tribunals, human rights tribunals. And those have a wonderful history.
Great track record
yeah,
there.
Wonderful. Now, just look up some of Jordan Peterson's early videos on that and kind of the speech requirements that he was talking about. You know, 5 years ago, whenever he hit the big hit the national stage. Mm-hmm. That's another bill that's coming down the pike. The kind of a companion bill to this, and not to run through it as extensively, but there's a private members bill from the NDP being presented that would ban hate symbols. So this would include swastikas and other Nazi emblems, Ku Klux Klan symbols, Confederate flags, any symbols of slavery, racism, or white supremacy would be banned from being sold or displayed in Canada. And again, the concern is like, who gets to define what these hate symbols are?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
A few things come to mind with that. Like, just using one of those as an example, obviously one of the most well-known, the swastika, it originates before Nazi Germany. And so you go to something like a Buddhist temple and you will find that symbol all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Does that define then as a hate symbol or not a hate symbol? Because if I remember correctly, it actually represents peace. So it's quite the opposite.
Yeah. Which is not a surprise. A lot of them, like that's how a lot of these kind of organizations and ideologies work is they co-opt other symbols and transform them.
But then even in the use as a hate symbol, does that apply then as well to something like somebody making a movie production or documentary type thing or something in that form? Are you saying they can't have it? How do they acquire it? Like you're putting it in a scenario where let's just pretend this doesn't exist anymore because we don't allow it on our soil.
Yeah. They're at least in other parts of the criminal code, it does have some, caveats for what you won't be convicted of. And so it says, no person shall be convicted or of an offense under subsection 2, and this is under public incitement of hatred and willful promotion of hatred. So these are laws already on the books. This is Canada Criminal Code section 319, and so the first two sections relate to public incitement of hatred and the willful promotion of hatred, and those were referenced in the. In the proposed new bylaw, right. The new criminal law, and then in the third part of that section, it says no person shall be convicted of an offense under subsection 2, if he establishes that the statements communicated were true. Again, who's defining what this statement is true is? And quite honestly, you can say a true statement in a very hateful way. Like there's nothing impossible about that.
Yeah.
so that, like I said, this is already on the books. Ugh. So it has that. So that caveat, there's a caveat related to whether this is being used in good faith as part of a religious, opinion or text, whether this is part of a public discussion or discussion in which the public would benefit. And then my favorite one is, if these hateful terms are being used in good faith as just reporting those. So how would you report a hate crime? You know, here's the flag my neighbor was holding up or if you have to repeat what hateful speech was, this carves out a caveat. Like you can't be charged with repeating the hate speech if it's for reporting purposes. I'm glad they put it in there. It'd be funny though if it wasn't. But yeah, so like I don't know. I guess like movies might be part of, you know, whether it's for the public benefit or something like that.
So there are some caveats in existing law
in there, but yeah, like I said, do you trust how those would be applied? But that's a very interesting kind of angle on it. Is how is the stories that we can tell one another about some of these past. Clear examples of hatred, of genocide, of evil.
Yeah.
It almost prevents people from just talking about it, period. And that to me sounds like a very dangerous way as well of moving forward.
Yeah.
If we can't even talk about some of these things for fear of these repercussions. So, you know, it's not unforeseeable to have, you know, a generation of kids grow up in the next 5-10 years who've never seen, you know, the swastika or know what that was used for because of these kind of laws. Good intentions having these kind of negative consequences, I think, in the end.
Yeah, you gotta look at that. Is it worth the loss of that kind of educational aspect to prevent the minimal gain of the few people that will have that symbol or use that symbol in a negative way.
Yeah. And that's, I think what I find with a lot of these laws is they're an overreaction to such a small subset of the population.
Yeah. Like you said about the trucker convoy group, the actual use of the swastika was very, very limited there.
Mm-hmm.
It, at least from the pictures that were made available and we all saw online or anywhere else, it was pretty limited. And that is helping push this anti-hate thing forward to say, well, there's all these hate symbols. We need to do something about it.
Yeah.
It's a very big reaction to one fairly small incident.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And yeah, it's, unfortunately, we're seeing this kind of instead of kind of confronting these things out in the open, like we try to closet them off as best as we can. Mm-hmm. And that's not going to solve anything. You have to deal with these things out in the light. And as good as, you know, as well-intentioned as these are, and you know, would a society without swastikas be better? Probably, I guess, if that's the only, if all other things being equal, you know, people waving the swastika around, I don't think you know, the society loses anything if that's yeah. taken away. But at what cost if we just try to push those into the shadows instead of exposing it to light, like that to me, I think it would be the better way, where the government is again trying to do a good thing that perhaps it's not best suited to do, and they're just taking a sledgehammer to something that was really a small nail, I think, in overall Canadian society, but something that should be that's easily refuted and ridiculed out in the open. Like,
yeah,
like who out there is going to go flying a Nazi flag just because in today's society?
Yeah,
like it's already effectively banned in that way, and only the hardcore lunatics are going to be doing that. You're just pushing them. You're pushing them to the shadows. They're always going to stay there. Bring them out. Expose them to the light. The ridicule. The societal scorn and shame, and they'll disappear.
Yeah.
So that's a bill to keep an eye on as the government moves forward with some of these significant legislation. Are we as uncertain as we might have been about government and hesitant about trusting government? I think all the more we should be aware of some of these changes. Mm-hmm. Good intentions, but that kind of power and responsibility is being wielded in very uncomfortable ways, to say the least. Dangerous ways, I think, is perhaps more accurate.
Yeah.
And so to our final story, and speaking of swastikas and Nazis, this story involves someone from the Freedom Convoy.
Just had to go there.
Yeah, I have to. Yeah. So one of these Nazi guys out there. There's a great story. Out in Arnprior, Ontario last week. This is about, I guess the story says it's about 70 kilometers west of Ontario of Ottawa. So this is last week. So the police moved in, cleared out Ottawa, and ended the emergency, the national emergency. And so a number of the truckers were moving out and starting to travel away. And the CBC wanted to get some comments and investigate and question some of the convoy, or this kind of remnant convoy as it's moving out of town. And so they show up at Arnprior where they're kind of camped out. And lo and behold, they get their minivan stuck at the gate of where the protesters or the Freedom Convoy had parked. And so one of these evil freedom truckers actually comes out and helps them. So I hope my sarcasm is coming through. I don't want you to think I'm being hateful or anything like that. But no, one of these good guys and the Freedom Truckers comes out, Tyson Guru, and comes out and he ends up using his truck to pull the CBC, and he knows these are CBC journalists, out of the ditch that they've got stuck in. Do you want to reveal the kicker on this?
There's just the greatest irony. At the time, he's wearing his Defund the CBC toque.
Yes. Oh, you couldn't make it up. This has all the hallmarks of like an hour. This hour is a 22-minute sketch, but this is a legitimate story. And so CBC reports it or at least tweets out that this has happened, that one of the truckers wearing the defund the police or defund the police. No, that's a different article. Defund the CBC toque has pulled them out. This gets some attention. I hadn't seen this before I read the article, but apparently Jason Kenney had come across this story as well, and had noted that that for all the differences we have seen in this country, a little bit of old-fashioned Canadian kindness goes a long way. And then he says, I nominate this for the new Canadian Heritage Minute. So yeah, we'll have a nice little black and white recreation of the Canadian Freedom Convoy trucker helping out the old helpless CBC van out of the ditch, reflecting the it seems like a fitting ending to this whole convoy and how it was portrayed in the media, that this nice ordinary Canadian who just wants some freedom, who's fighting for his freedom, helps out the you know, I use it facetiously, the evil CBC guys or journalists out of the ditch. Like, it just,
for all the disagreements, for all the issues he may have, he's still there to help his fellow Canadian.
And that's the thing. If you got past the headlines and the talking points, from the Liberals and the NDPs, this isn't a surprise. This fits with how the convoyers were actually portraying themselves and all the other videos. This fits in with the block party mentality, and good naturedness of this protest. Like, I don't know if we've really understood the remarkable nature of this convoy, of having 10,000 plus people for three, and not the whole time, but a protest go on for 3 weeks like this, and there isn't one broken window to be reported. There isn't one act of violence.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you might say there'll be some alleged claims. There wasn't one statue torn down. I haven't seen one wall of graffiti. Like, it's a stunning protest. I don't know. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that in my lifetime when it comes to protests of this length, particularly with this many people, and there not be some sort of violent end to it.
Yeah, for the mob mentality to not take over in 3 weeks, like, that happens in almost every protest, no matter how peaceful it starts out. At some point, kind of that mob mentality, they people get each other worked up and things happen. And for it to not ever scale up to that level is impressive.
Yeah, I really don't know how they did that. But
this is a fitting end to it, coming out of that protest and still, instead of stopping and laughing at the CBC people, he pulls out a chain, hooks up his truck, and helps tow them out.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, well done, Tyson. You have shown, I think, you just personified the kind of the spirit of the convoy and the general good naturedness of Canadians overall. So I hopefully that's kind of an encouraging ending. We can still help out our enemies. I think there's something biblical around there, something about that, about praying for our enemies and blessing those that persecute us. Not saying that they're being persecuted, just making the connection that we don't have to be at each other's throats. We don't have to laugh at the guy in the ditch. We can actually help pull him out, even if we don't like him. Mm-hmm. So maybe there is your takeaway for this episode. Pull your enemy out of the ditch. You can do that. And if you wear defund the CBC, all the better. All right. So thank you for hanging out with us. Hope you learned something along the way. My name is Brian Constein.
And I'm Michael Rowland.
And this has been Penhold Talk Radio.